Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and normally each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. But this time, as a special bonus episode, we wanted to cover the brand new and last final, this time we promise, single Now and Then, with its accompanying music video by acclaimed filmmaker Peter Jackson, as well as a 12-minute short documentary about the making of the recording. But first, let's quickly cover off our reactions to the single itself. Ed, what did you think of the song? Has Paul taken a sad song and made it better?
He's good at that, isn't he? I think it's lovely. So, I mean, Now and Then, because I have heard the demo before. I did hear it years ago, but when, and I think you did the same, actually, from what we said the other day, that when I heard that they were going to do something with Now and Then, I deliberately didn't go back and listen to the demo because I wanted to be surprised by it. And it's not, I mean, so the song is not an enormous surprise in general. I find it quite funny that the three piano songs that John recorded in the Dakota, which Yoko gave Paul on cassette, Free as a Bird, Real Love, and Now and Then, are all basically the same rhythm because John Lennon played piano in the same way I play piano, i.e. chords.
Yeah.
Chords in a, you know, he was a perfectly good pianist, but not an amazing one. He essentially could back himself with chords, which is what he was doing. So they're all kind of in the same rhythm.
It's also interesting that presumably that's the extent of his home demos. Like, it surprised me that weren't any unused home demos of him playing like a rock and roll riff, you know, that are just on an acoustic guitar or something. And there was something like that they could use.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I do remember, I think he said that he sort of had got into the mood of writing songs on piano rather than guitar because he didn't know the piano as well, and so he could sort of surprise himself a bit, you know, and he felt that the sort of accidents it created led to interesting places, you know. But yeah, I think it's a really lovely song. I mean, listen, it's not like it's the best Beatles song. Of course it isn't. If it was as good as Lady Madonna, then it wouldn't have sat in a cupboard for 25
yeah,
years, right?
Yeah.
You know, but I think that what they've done brilliantly is create a story around it and told us that story very effectively. And I think the story itself augments and complements the song perfectly. And I think it's nice, and I think it's emotional, and I think they've done a good job all around.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't really have any expectations at all because I hadn't even heard the demo. And when I knew that they were going to work on this, I deliberately didn't seek that out so I could be surprised. What I was surprised by was how much I instantly loved it. I've seen a lot of people talk about how it's growing on them over time. But yeah. I guess maybe because I didn't have any expectations going in, I just found the whole thing really, really lovely. It's a very emotional song. It's a lovely melody. I think that the melody of his singing does surprise you in places, which is nice. It feels sort of fresh in that way sometimes.
Yeah.
And I know there's a lot of debate about whether or not it should really count as a Beatles song. I don't really understand that. I think if you look at all of the factors by which you might define what makes a Beatles song, this ticks all of those boxes. You know, they're all playing on it, which isn't true of every Beatles song. The idea that Paul and Ringo are much older now, don't see why that should count against the recording at all. You know, the idea presumably being that a Beatles song can only be a Beatles song if it was released specifically in that 10-year period, which doesn't make sense to me when other bands are allowed to grow old and change and stuff over time. So I really like the song on first listen, but also to the Beatle argument, or adding to the Beatle debate, it does feel like there have been a lot of elements that have been added to the song to make it feel Beatlesque enough.
There's a
lovely sort of guitar feel just before it heads into the chorus, which makes me think of Abbey Road and Let It Be sessions, the kind of thing they used to do on a lot of those songs. The strings have like a nice sort of staccato element to them, which immediately reminded me of Eleanor Rigby. The strings at the end go a little bit surreal, and it brought to mind I Am the Walrus. So yeah, and I think that by association, there are parts of the song where immediately my head was like, oh, that sounds a bit like that, and that sounds a bit like that, which is enough for me to think it fits neatly in the canon in its place as the last song made 30 years after the last song.
Yeah, I think they've got enough elements in there to make it sound sort of Beatle-y without making it sound sort of too Beatle-y, if you like a sort of pastiche of Beatleness, you know. So if you think about like George's song When We Was Fab, which is like very much, which I think Jeff Lynne produced, like, and I think he sort of must have said to Jeff Lynne, just make this as Beatle-y as you can. And he really went all out with the mellotrons and the strings and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Back then, long time ago, when grass was green, woke up in a daze, arrived like strangers in the night. Fab. Long time ago, when we was fab.
You know, because sometimes there are things. I was in a pub the other week, and they were playing a song, and I thought, this sounds very Beatle-y. What is it? And it was Sowing the Seeds of Love by Tears for Fears, but it's got that sort of Baroque, Beatlesque thing going on, you know. So, but Now and Then isn't doing quite that. But actually, it raises the question of like, do you need to make something sound Beatle-y when it is the Beatles? Isn't it just yes, the exactly. fact that it is the Beatles performing the song in and of itself makes it Beatle-y, right? Has it in fact redefined what Beatle-y is? You know?
Yes, exactly, yeah. The other question about all of that people have been debating a lot online is, again, this question of to what extent does AI, the use of AI isolating John's vocal, make it not a Beatles record or not even a proper, authentic Lennon recording? The interesting thing about that is that I feel like Paul made those perhaps slightly misguided comments earlier in the year where he said they'd been using AI to finish the song, and everyone immediately went into uproar about having a fake Lennon on the song. And then that was obviously clarified that it was Peter Jackson's technology and that AI being used in that sense to just isolate the track. But I find it interesting that we sort of talk about that in terms of it being one or the other, and not that the way I see that as being a bit more nuanced and a bit more of a grey area, because no matter how the AI is being employed to isolate John's voice, there will be some cleaning up or some restoration of that recording that's gone into that process. And I guess that in itself is immediately adding some embellishment to the recording using technology rather than, you know, just using the recording as it stood on its own. So you know, I guess the question is, where do you draw the line? And you can't really easily answer that question. But also don't think you should need to answer that question, because, you know, the Beatles themselves employed many technological tricks when they were around that led to their voices sounding different. And as Paul says in the documentary, using new technology is something that the Beatles always loved doing. So it shouldn't really take away from this idea that it's authentic or not, because it feels very much in keeping with the band either way.
Yeah, I mean, what is real and what is a trick? You know, I think that's sort of where people's thoughts are going. Like, is this trickery of some kind, and is it therefore? Because, you know, my limited understanding of what a sort of machine learning can do in terms of extracting someone's voice from a tape of a voice and a piano is that in doing that extraction, it fills in the gaps by learning what John Lennon's voice sounds like and putting in sort of 3 milliseconds here of John Lennon singing this note and another 3 milliseconds over there to plug the little gaps it finds. I suppose that's very broadly what it's doing. And so John's voice that you hear. So, I mean, in the documentary, there's a really good effect where you just hear John's vocal track on its own sort of cleaned up, and it sounds amazing, you know, and it's quite a sort of heart-stopping moment as well.
It really
build
is.
Up to it very effectively.
Yeah.
So it's not that what you're hearing there is an AI that sounds like John Lennon. It's John Lennon with a few bits where it had to separate. If he was hitting the piano key at the exact same time as singing the note, then it has had to fill in that gap by taking how he would have sung it and planting it in there, that kind of thing. So is that John Lennon or is it not John Lennon? This is a guy who certainly at one stage in his life prized authenticity above all things. You know, you should probably factor that in as well. But I agree with you. I don't think it's a debate that particularly needs to be had, you know, because, I mean, if they'd come to the conclusion, well, no, it's not proper, we shouldn't do it, I would much rather have this song than not have this song, you know.
Yeah.
And if this is the only way to do it, you know, then great.
And I think, you know, when the first AI comments from Paul surfaced, there was a whole spate of people suddenly, you know, producing AI tracks. You know, here's what it would sound like if Paul sang God Only Knows and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I guess there's a question in people's minds of, well, what's the difference between allowing that kind of thing and calling it a Beatles recording and the use of AI here to the minimal extent that you just explained? And the obvious difference is this is labeled as the Beatles. This is an official release by the Beatles. This is something that has been signed off on and sanctioned by the Beatles. So that makes it an official Beatles recording, and everything else isn't.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but I suppose, does it mean that, you know, a few years from now, someone at Apple, you know, maybe wants Paul and Ringo are gone, think, well, what else is there lying around we can release? Do they get hold of the Palace of the King of the Birds, i.e. an instrumental they recorded in the Let It Be sessions, and think, well, this is good, but we could get an AI to imagine the lyrics that John and Paul might have written for it, and we can get an AI to sing a John and Paul harmony vocal on it, you know, that kind of thing. You know, so, I mean, I think I would probably think that was going too far. But who knows? Like, maybe we as a society reach a point in a few years' time, we probably will, whereby artificial intelligence has been embedded into our day-to-day lives to such an extent that these things just feel kind of normal. In a way, at the moment, they feel a bit scary. I imagine we'll probably all have accepted them a bit more in a few years' time.
You know, you've reached a very serious part of the debate when you actually use the phrase "we as a society." The other element to all of this as well that it probably shouldn't go unreferenced is that Giles took actual recordings of the backing vocals from other songs and inserted them here, which I don't see as much debate about, you know, like that presumably raises just as many questions about inauthenticity, but no one seems worried about that.
Yeah, but I suppose there's in terms of doing that, at least that's taking like actual vocals that they performed, albeit on another song, and applying them to another one. So arguably not that much different to the Love album, or even gluing together the long medley on side two of Abbey Road you know, not necessarily things that were, again, it's a question of where you draw that line, I suppose.
It's a really good point. I think the Love album is a slightly different thing because it's positioned as a remix album. But yeah, it's a good point about the Abbey Road medley. I think that makes sense. I think just on that as well, I don't know if you noticed, but I haven't been able to pick out the Eleanor Rigby backing vocals, but right at the very end of the guitar solo in the single, the backing vocals at that point feels very clearly to me like backing vocals from Because. Like the harmonies are just exactly what you get from that song.
Yes, definitely. So there are vocals from Here, There and Everywhere in there as well, apparently, which I think I spotted, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head exactly where. But no, Eleanor Rigby vocals, no, I can't. Maybe we should get an AI to extract it. And
let's reverse engineer this thing.
Yeah.
But having said that as well, it's actually also nice, I think, to hear older Paul and older Ringo on the recording, which you can pick out their voices. I particularly like hearing Ringo's really low "now," you know, when they sing the "Now and Then" part. It's a really really deep voice, but unmistakably him.
Yeah I really like it. Reminds me of on Carry That Waits, where they're all singing, and you can Ringo's is the most identifiable voice in the whole thing, because it's completely unmistakable. I really like the fact that, I don't know if you remember, but like, I forget when it was, but earlier this year, sort of randomly, Penn Jillette from Penn and Teller like, claimed to have heard Now and Then, and was saying they've de-aged, like, Paul's voice is in it, but they've de-aged him so he sounds like he was in the 60s, and everyone went a bit mad about that. I mean, who knows whether that is what they did and then they saw the public reaction to that and decided to change it. But either way, it is a very good decision to have Paul's voice in it as it is now, but sort of a bit lower in the mix than John's. And they can kind of harmonize together like they do, like they do when he does I've Got a Feeling live, you know, the John duet thing. You know, I think that's a really good decision and I think it works.
Yeah, but I will also say that I think my main takeaway from all of that is that Penn Jillette was then and remains a questionable authority on what is coming out of the Beatles pipeline at all times.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, he's not the first person I look to for information about official Apple releases, you know.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But talking about having the older voices sit alongside the earlier recordings, that brings us quite neatly onto the concept for Peter Jackson's music video that accompanies the song.
Yeah.
What did you make of that?
Well, I really like the video. It's funny that I don't know if you were watching the YouTube premiere. So if you're watching the YouTube premiere, there's a brief introduction from Paul at the start, which takes about sort of 10 seconds or so, and basically says, when we asked Peter Jackson to do it, and he said, I've never done a music video before, and I'm not sure I can on this, but we let him do it anyway. And I think he's passed the audition, I think he said. the concept is, I like the fact it's respectful, but it's not too serious. In fact, it's very funny in places, and I think that's a really good decision. This could have been so reverential, and it could have been really framed around like, we've got John's voice in it, and it's a ghost from the past and all this kind of stuff. Mm. And actually, it's nice that sort of there's footage of John in it that they've got from the Hello Goodbye video, where he's just mucking about and doing the twist and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think it's really fun. I think there are some odd sort of uncanny valley choices that are made in it. But in general, I really like the concept and I think it's really well realized.
Yeah, well realized is exactly it. I think we said to each other yesterday before we'd seen the music video that you don't hire Peter Jackson to do like a normal montage of, you know, here's lots of archive footage and stuff. So
yeah,
I think we were both expecting there was always going to be a sort of a gimmick that was going to be used in the video. I think it's lovely. Mm. I think the footage where they suddenly appear alongside Ringo and Paul, and it looks enough like they're in the room, George and John are in the room with them, for it to be really quite lovely. I think the fact that they almost only use footage of them mucking about is a really nice way of showcasing the Beatles via their personality rather than their musicianship, which we've spoken before about the importance in the past and how a lot of films tend to miss that sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think by doing that, the contrast between the young and old versions of them actually becomes more powerful and more poignant and more emotional as a result by showing them having fun rather than by showing them all serious and, you know, grave.
Yeah, true. I think reminds me of something. I think George once said that the Beatles and Monty Python should get together and sort of form the ultimate music and comedy supergroup, you know, because he sort of loved the Ruttles for that reason as well, because he really got the idea that the Beatles were a laugh, you know.
Yeah.
And and that really comes across in this.
The way that footage is used in the shot as well is really clever, because I think Jackson employs a lot of tricks to make it feel like they're in the room more than they would do normally. And it's just really simple things you don't necessarily think about while you're watching. Like when the camera pans past the group, that footage sort of slightly blurs a little bit as it would do naturally if they were in shot. There's sort of a depth perception there where I think there's a great shot of John looking back, and it looks like he's looking back at present day Ringo drumming, and John's out of focus because the focus is on Ringo. And also they seem to have got the lighting right, which is nice, you know, to make that all seem like it's all in the same room. And also quite clever decisions made, I think, where the footage that's used when they're actually playing their instruments is sort of generally enough that you can be kidded into thinking that they were playing along with that actual song.
Yeah.
You know, when they're singing, like it's like kind of like on a long note, and it you know, you could be mistaken for thinking that it's the same syllable, you know. It just feels very like a lot of work has gone into making it feel like they are part and parcel of this particular track.
Yeah, I think, and obviously they've got footage of Paul, George and Ringo playing the actual song in 1995, so that's kind of easy enough to marry up. I think with things like this, you can kind of go too far in trying to make it look like the person is actually mouthing the words of the song, you know, like trying to find some footage of John singing the word now when he was alive, you know. You could end up just copying and pasting like three of them, where, you know, it's like three different him singing the words now and then three different videos of him, you know. But actually what it's trying to do is capture a mood, and it's doing that really effectively. I really like the fact that when you see Ringo standing at the microphone singing, and he's sort of mugging for the camera and he's loving it, you know, he's wearing a t-shirt with his own face on, and, you know, and brilliant. It's exactly what you want from Ringo. But he's mirroring what John is doing in 1967 in the Hello Goodbye video, you know. I always thought like that footage, that Hello Goodbye, which they shot on, was it a West End theater? It's probably the Savile Theater that Brian Epstein used to own, I think. And they're just kind of standing on stage playing the song. And they are mucking about, like stamping their feet and stuff. But John in particular is sort of doing a thing where he's doing sort of Elvis impersonations and things like that.
That's right, yeah.
And it's just in the era when he started to wear his glasses, and he's not wearing his glasses in this for whatever reason, which kind of just makes him look a bit younger. And it's just, I just always found it funny that in this sort of psychedelic era where you're sort of encouraged to believe that, everything's getting serious now, but they're sort of engaged with big concepts now. But he's just still mucking about doing the twists for the cameras just because he fancies it. You know, it's lovely to see.
You're right. I think the music video itself is filled with like little moments that just sort of raise a smile. But I also feel like it ends really well. The bow, a nice, neat touch to Beatlemania with the sort of rows of girls in seats supposedly at live performances they sort of out, and then the fading of the lights on Beatles as it, you know, really feels like a sort of a final touch to the video and to cap off their entire career.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, one of the things about the Beatles is one part of the appeal has always been that it's a story. It's a really engaging story because it kind of has an end, you know, because they split up, you know, in the same way that other bands who have just been going on and on and on since the 60s, and like not to knock them at all, but like it's not as compelling. And so I think putting a sort of proper end to this story, it would have been, I'm sure that Paul is probably motivated at least in part by thinking about his legacy and what he wants to do with the time he has left. You know, I think yeah. He is probably starting to think in those terms a little bit. I do get that impression, you know, with the stuff he's been releasing. He's obviously been rooting around in his cupboards and thinking, what else is there? You know, oh, here's all the photographs I took when we were on tour in the early 60s. I could do something with them. You know, he set up the exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery in London, which I went to a few weeks ago. It was absolutely brilliant. And, you know, he's releasing the lyrics book, which is probably the closest we'll ever get to a McCartney autobiography. Well, so he's done the Many Years From Now memoir, but the lyrics is more of a sort of proper full life autobiography, or close to it, through the lyrics of his songs and discussion of them. So I think he's thinking in those terms. And I think he's probably thinking the Beatles is the sort of defining artistic achievement of my life, and it feels slightly unfinished. And of course, mm-hmm. you know, the thing about the Now and Then itself as a song is that John, I'm sure, wrote this song about Yoko to the extent he wrote it about anyone. I'm sure that's who he was thinking of, you know. But that doesn't diminish the idea that it means something to Paul, you know. That, yeah. There is that story about someone, I think it was Carl Perkins, in the 80s, a couple of years after John died, was sort of visiting Paul. It was sort of, they were playing together on some song. And Carl said the words Now and Then to Paul, who sort of went off and had a bit of a cry, and Linda explained, like, he still hasn't processed John's death. And the last phone call they had, John used it, sort of signed off by saying, think of me now and then, old friend, I think it was. But it sort of, it made me think, actually, that one of the things about music and about musical instruments is that they can be a way of connecting people. So John Lennon can play chords on his piano in 1977 or 1978 in his flat in New York. And then decades later, Paul McCartney can get this tape and he can go, oh, okay, so he's in A minor, I think. Okay, fine. So I can play, we'll work out the guitar chords and we can play along to it, and I can add bass to this. So I know which notes to play because my instrument is tuned the same as his. And I think it's a really lovely idea that he can look at that, he can take the music that his friend played, and decades later, because of this system, you know, of just sort of notation, I suppose it is, or just this system by which these instruments can be tuned to one another, then if I tune my instrument to yours, just like we tuned our guitars to each other when we were teenagers 65 years ago, then in some way, the two of us are together again, you know. I think it's a really lovely idea.
It is, and yeah, it's universal, isn't it? And I think that it's I think that's why the concept of the video works so well, because you're seeing a very visual representation of that, and it feels powerful for that, because it's not just combining the old and the young, it's combining old friends that are separated by a death, you know, yeah. Like, you know, bringing lost loved ones back into the present. All of those things just through the power of music.
Yeah, it's lovely. Although I don't think Paul and Ringo are in the same room, are they?
They look a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think
superimposed.
Because also in the documentary it does say, Ringo says, oh, and then Paul sent me the files and yes. I drummed on them and sent them back. You know.
On this note, I think I could be accused of reading too much into things and overthinking this a bit, but I'm gonna present you a theory anyway. The song starts with a counting, and I think there was a rumor beforehand that it was going to be George, but it sounds like Paul to me. Do you agree?
Yes, it sounds like Paul to me. Yeah.
I think, like, you know, if you have this idea that the every inch of this song would have been really thought through and worked over for many months, I think you can assume that the inclusion of that count in was considered important. I think one of the reasons why it's important is because I think it's on their first recording. Is that right, the count in?
It's on the first song on their first album. Yeah. So
it feels like it's a sort of rounding things off.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what it's intended to do.
I feel like, and this is the point where you might say I'm overthinking it, I think it's very pointed that he counts in 1, 2, and then the right. 3 is very faded and there's no 4. You know, I think that is, I feel like, you know, as a counting on 4 notes to count in a song and to do like a half of that counting, you know, that is a like a reference almost to the remaining members of the band.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. An allusion to the idea that, like, you know, we're all here, but we're not quite all here. You know, I think,
yeah.
I think that there is, there's footage of John that they've used. I think it's in the documentary rather than the music video, but there's footage of John they've used from, I think it's the Hey Jude recording session. And his face is sort of generally, it's slightly obscured. So it's kind of like his face is slightly hidden behind a microphone and the music stand.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, which I thought was probably a deliberate choice because I think it's trying to stress, you know, he's here, but he's not quite here. You know, we're not, we're not trying to get away with the idea that this is, you know, 100% Beatles. They're being respectful and sort of paying homage in the best way they know how. And I think all those little things like that are being very well judged in general.
I completely agree. Yeah, being respectful is exactly it. I felt the same way and I made the same note looking at that documentary. I think that they're not trying to present it as something that it's not. I think they've made some very smart, creative choices around what footage they use to sort of present John as being part of this recording without making it seem like he was in the room with them. The other thing as well I wanted to mention about the single is I'm waiting for someone to figure out what is said right at the end of the song. So right. As the song ends and fades out, I can just about make out that there's someone says something, and it's probably just like a studio, bit of studio noise, you know, someone finishing a take or something. But to have left it in, it feels like it would be good to really know what that is.
Yeah, of course, because, you know, obviously that's no accident. So
and I'm not expecting like a big Easter egg like they included at the end of Free as a Bird, but, you know, it would be good to good to know.
What if you play it backwards and it says Paul is dead?
Yes. That's what we're all hoping for, let's be honest. One of the things I was going to ask you was you saw the 12-minute documentary. Did you see it when it was shown on The One Show as the UK premiere?
No, I saw it on YouTube later on.
Well, one of the brilliant things that you missed by it being on The One Show was that they showed the 12-minute documentary, and then there's the story in the documentary about how the string orchestra that recorded for the song didn't actually know what song it was that they were recording for. They were kept in the dark about that. What The One Show did was they tracked down, you can see him in the documentary, his name is Charlie Bisharat.
Oh, I saw he's got a name.
I think he's one of the violinists.
He's got a name tag on while he's playing, right?
That's right. So what they did was they tracked him down. And as we were watching as an audience, the TV audience, we were watching the documentary, they had set up a camera on him so that he could see that for the first time at the same time as it was broadcast to get his live reaction to him finally realizing that he is playing on the very last Beatles track.
Yeah.
He was fine with it. There's a couple of things there that they kind of, I mean, first of all, when you track someone down and he knows he's doing something like important when he's recording that. And I think he recorded like a year before or something, or a year and a half before. Yeah. But when you set a camera on him, like he knows that this is for something big. So he's probably already kind of guessed at that point what it was for. Mm. So it wasn't probably a massive surprise for him. But also they introduce him afterwards and then talk to him very, very briefly and say, like, you know, you have played on loads of iconic songs, like, you know, worked with some of the greatest film composers and you played in the Titanic soundtrack. So actually, it's not like he's a competition winner. Like, he's a very talented person, right? Yeah. Like, he's already got lots and lots of like fantastic credits to his name, and this is just one more of them. So there was no, they basically showed the footage of him watching it for the first time when he appears on screen, and there's just no reaction. And then they asked him a couple of questions afterwards, and they were like, okay, great, thanks for speaking to you, and he just left. And it was a real, like, I think they were really hoping for some like amazing shock moment and stuff, just didn't deliver at all.
Yeah, I think actually that's in a grand old tradition of the sort of classical musicians who played on Beatles songs in the 60s were quite unimpressed by the whole thing in general. So a lot of them kind of felt like it was beneath them and had to be, and things like had to be really cajoled into doing things that they didn't really think were proper, you know. So things like the big ascending, go from your lowest note to your highest note thing on A Day in the Life, you know, a lot of them needed a lot of cajoling and talking into, that kind of thing. But yeah, in general, that's quite nice that you have someone, and probably more than one of them, who are just like, oh, okay, the Beatles, is it? Good, fine. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, to be fair, sorry, I don't want to misrepresent him, because he was like, oh, this is fantastic. Like, it was great. But it was, I feel like he'd already come to terms with the news by the time he was interviewed. And I think what they wanted was to have him in a state of excitement where he'd just found out. And I think, you know, he just very much taken it in his stride. But anyway, one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about the documentary, and also just about the release of the single itself, is it does feel like the narrative around why the song is coming out now rather than back in 1995 has been repositioned slightly. Mm. So I think we have always understood that they were working on the song. George didn't like the song, and that was the main reason why it was shelved. You know, George, playing up to his sort of cranky reputation, decided he'd had enough, and then they just left it there. There's been understandably a big shift in the framing of that to the technology wasn't able to make it right at that time, and now we finally have the right technology to do it justice.
Yeah, it does seem that way. One of the interesting things about this whole project is that Paul said in a documentary about Jeff Lynne from 2012 called Mr. Blue Sky that there was a third one we were doing, but George went off it.
But there were three that we liked: Freeze a Bird, Real Love. And so those were the two that we did. And there was another one that we started working on, but George went off it. Fucking hell. Fucking rubbish, this is. It was like, no, George, this is John. It's still fucking rubbish, you know. Oh, okay, then. So that one's still lingering around somewhere. I'm going to nick in with Jeff and do it, finish it one of these days.
And it's nice that the key to the end of the Beatles has been sitting around for 11 years, hiding in plain sight in this documentary about Jeff Lynne. You know, it's all there. Okay. You know, because I'm very familiar with that clip, but for me, it's just always been quite a funny YouTube clip where Paul does a bit of an impression of George, and and it's quite a funny thing about George being a bit grumpy. But it never occurred to me really that they would do anything with the song. Or that anyone really had an appetite to do anything with the song. But actually, one of the things about this, the voiceover in the documentary, is that there's sort of extended bit of that audio in the BBC radio series called Eras, which is on BBC Sounds now. I'll put a link in the description. And so they released, the same day as the song, they released the final episode of it. So it's Martin Freeman presenting it, and it's sort of going through the sort of various eras of the Beatles' career, the last one being Now and Then. And it has slightly longer audio of the voiceover from this documentary, in which Paul gives a bit more clarity about it, where he says, well, I rung up Olivia and said, look, we know that George didn't like it, but we both know why George didn't like it. It was because of this technical thing, you know. And so Olivia very much seems to go along with that. So basically, like, yes, it does seem to be being reframed, but Olivia and Danny seem perfectly happy with the thing, and that's good enough for me. I don't think there's no need for me to interrogate it much further than that. But yes, it is certainly being reframed a little bit, just as, you know, the Get Back documentary is a reframing of what we, how we perceived it before. You know, all of these things are just sort of shifting perceptions. You know, it's, as we've discussed a few times when we've talked about documentaries, it's not necessarily about what is a fact and what is not a fact. It's more about that different perceptions add to your overall personal perception of the thing.
Yeah, exactly that. And I think I also feel like both of those things can be true, right? The technical issue was the reason why George was frustrated, and focusing on one part of that event doesn't necessarily make the other thing untrue either. It's just it makes sense now that the focus is on the technology because that's, I guess, what also makes it exciting. And one of the things that whole thing does lead to is one of my favorite moments in the 12-minute documentary, which is when we have footage from the anthology era of George talking about the use of computers to finish something. And he says, you can use a computer to do all of that, but it opens up a whole other... And then he says, kettle of fish. And then Paul says, can of worms. And then Ringo basically says, a year of work. Which is a really neat insight into how they all individually think that sentence should be finished.
Yeah. But it's a nice bit of sort of Beatle banter where they're sort of finishing each other's sentences.
You know, that's computer stuff. You know, I was telling you a year ago, Jeff was doing this thing on his computer, but it opens up a whole other kettle of fish.
Can of worms.
But will it open another year of work?
But also, you know, I like the fact that George is saying, oh, computers are going to be a big deal. You know, he's just so ahead of his time, you know, like when David Bowie predicted the internet will change everything.
Yeah,
know?
Of course.
You know, George was predicting computers would be significant, you know.
But I think the difference there is that when David Bowie says it is like, you know, what an exciting time and what an opportunity. There's so much potential, Jay. And George is kind of saying it as, computers are going to be a big thing and I can't really be done with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think, on his, like, there's bits from the, around his last album, Brainwashed, the posthumous album, there was a little bit of documentary footage that was released, sort of maybe 15 minutes or so. And there are bits in that where I think he's sort of talking about mobile phones and how he thinks they're rubbish and he hates them, you know, which is just fantastic. I love it. But yeah, what they've done with the anthology footage, and there's quite a lot of new footage here from the 90s, which is great. For me, it sort of suggests a bit of a way forward with it, because it's been restored and it looks a lot better than it did. One of the things about the anthology is that, you know, I think people have been saying for a few years, it's like, well, they should just release the Beatles anthology to Netflix or Disney Plus or whatever, if they sort of want this younger audience to come along. I've always thought... Yes, but the problem with that is that the talking heads, i.e. the contemporary interviews, look outdated now because they were shot 30 years ago. They've all got sort of 90s hair and clothes. In fact, they were still wearing sort of 80s hair and clothes in the 90s, you know. So I'm not sure, like, the young audience is going to get it. But it did occur to me, sort of looking at this restored footage, because it looks lovely, all this footage of them in the studio, is that maybe what you could do is a new documentary that is about the making of Free as a Bird, Real Love, and Now and Then, all with restored footage, because there's obviously a lot of footage, you can tell. So I mean, by the way, they're all in the footage going around filming each other with camcorders, you know, so let's dig that out and restore it. I'm sure that's been done.
Yeah.
And there's lots of restored footage in the music video and in other and in the documentary, so things like the Paperback Writer video and the Hey Jude recording sessions. There's a little bit of footage from the Hey Jude performance on the David Frost Show that doesn't look to have been restored, and they like quite quickly cut away from it because you can kind of tell the difference. But I kind of think that if you made a new documentary about the making of those three songs, that would kind of pave the way for a sort of remastered anthology, because it would get people used to the idea that the 90s was an era of the Beatles, that they were doing things creatively in the 90s. And so then what you can do is take the footage, the interview footage that was shot in the 90s, remaster that, but it can then be viewed alongside the 60s interviews that are in that documentary and just to be seen as footage from an era of the Beatles, if you know what I mean.
Yes. And so it's all archive footage at that point, right?
Right, exactly. And it would kind of make sense that way. And of course, as part of that project, I'm sure you would also dig up new things, put new things in, restore other things and change the whole thing around. You know, you wouldn't necessarily just take the exact same TV show and restore what's there. I'm sure there'd be things in there you'd take the opportunity to sort of improve and augment and things like that.
I think that's true. And I think what's really exciting about that is the fact that that work has gone into this documentary and that video goes to show the scope of the potential for what is coming further down the line that we still don't even know about yet. Because you can guarantee there is something, whatever that is. And I guess that's a nice way to think about this project, the Now and Then project, and the single, the video, the documentary, the three things that have landed with us this week. It's a nice way to think of that as much as marking the end of the Beatles' career officially, but also the start of a new beginning of other things and new things to be excited about that will be released down the pipeline, which is a nice way of looking at it. And also probably a nice way to end the discussion on it and throw it out to anybody listening now. As always, we'd love for you to get in touch with us with your thoughts on the song, the video, the documentary, and also your hopes for what you might like to see from some of this restored footage further down the line. As always, you can reach us on all the usual social media platforms. We are at Beatles Films Pod. You can also leave us a 5-star rating or a review on your podcast listening platform of choice. Otherwise, we'll be back to our usual scheduled programming, and we'll see you again for another episode soon. Thanks for listening again, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.